the sort of joy and escapism and almost like superhero like, you know, scenery and fun that these that was in these videos and sort of even in the sound, the bigness of the music was something. It was like this, it was like a, an escape, you know, and it was something also totally aspirational, where like you were, you know, if you were a kid like me who played guitar, you like you just wanted to be CeCe DeVille or Vito Bratta.
That's Tom Bojor, the co-author of the book Nothing But a Good Time. I'm Jamie Green, and this is Trading Fours.
I'm going to Kansas City. Kansas City, here I come. Oh, yeah.
Hey, everybody. Welcome back to another edition of Trading Fours. I hope you're doing well. I'm your host, Jamie Green. And today we are going to talk about this amazing book, Nothing But a Good Time. The Uncensored History of the 80s Hard Rock Explosion. And for those of you that don't know, I'm a total Gen Xer. I graduated from high school in 1986, so this is an era that I know quite well, extremely well. And for the younger folks that don't know, it used to be a big deal. We used to sit around our house for hours watching MTV. And MTV used to play actual music videos. I mean, this is how long ago this is. And we would wait and watch and hope that the videos we loved would come on. My absolute favorite was Hot for Teacher by Van Halen. There's a lot of them. So it's so much fun to talk to Tom. He dialed in. And what I found really interesting, you think of all these big bands, Guns N' Roses, Warrant, Poison, Motley Crue, LA Guns, the list goes on and on. But they were all in a really small neighborhood where they knew each other. And they played at a lot of the same places and gigs and stuff. And so it's almost like when it's like, you know, that 7 degrees or 6 degrees of separation with Kevin Bacon. Well, with these bands, it's about a degree or maybe two. So a lot of fun. Really enjoyed this chat. So let's get started. Here's my conversation with Tom Bojor. All right, man. I have to tell you, you're talking my language. I graduated from high school in 1986. So reading this book and, a lot of it I knew, but a lot of it I didn't know. It was like the best time travel trip back to some of the funnest times. And Tom, I think that one thing for my younger listeners that probably aren't going to understand, you forget how much fun 80s rock and roll was, right? They had a great time.
I think that that was one of the most attractive aspects of like the 80s hard rock stuff. Certainly for me, I was high school class of 89. So I, you know, when Poison was coming out and these bands were coming out, I'm 14, 13, 15. And the sort of joy and escapism and almost like superhero, like, you know, scenery and fun that these, that was in these videos and sort of even in the sound, the bigness of the music was something. It was like this, it was like an escape, you know, and it was something also totally aspirational, where like you were, you know, if you were a kid like me who played guitar, you like you just wanted to be CeCe DeVille or Vito Bratta. And you know, the way the videos made these guys look, it was like these guys are living the best possible life. And you know, it was also a time where there was kind of like a monoculture. So it was like all of us were watching the same videos on MTV. So like we all saw the Poison videos. We all saw the Motley Crue videos. So it was like a massive number of people who were exposed to this music and a common language. And I think that's why the book has been getting such good responses. Like there were a lot of us, you know, who saw this stuff. And not just the heavy metal, but for me, it was the glam rock or the heavy metal. And it completely went into our like undeveloped prefrontal cortexes at the age of 15. And it does not leave when that's the age that it enters.
No, not at all. It's just, you know, you're so right about that. I mean, we'd sit there for hours just waiting to watch a video that we loved. You know, you didn't tape it. You had to just sit there and we just sit there and sit through stupid. Cause you know, I think Hot for Teacher is still probably my all time favorite. Like this is the greatest video ever, right?
Absolutely. Yeah.
Yeah. And I think it is such a cultural thing. It's what we all did and we all talked about and you know, there wasn't 1,000 choices. You had your rock station, maybe 2 rock stations in your hometown. You had MTV and you had these guys coming through and playing concerts and that was pretty much it. So it's such a great cultural shared experience.
Absolutely. And, you know, I mean, that's one of the reasons Rich and I even embarked on this book is he's a couple years younger. He's a mere 45 years old. But he got into this stuff really young. And the reason we decided to do this book is we had worked together on and off since about 1996 at Guitar World magazine. Mm-hmm. And any time that we were not talking about work and probably even when we should have been talking about work, our conversation would drift immediately towards the metal of the 80s. And we'd be like talking about Warrant and the different, you know, values of these, is the first record better, is the second record better? Like that's our sports, mm-hmm. you know? And so it's a complete bonding thing. It's like a tribe of people that, you know, you can just start talking about this stuff. And the level of knowledge and nostalgia is huge because it was also a music that disappeared completely.
Yeah.
And I think that that has something to do with it too. The fact that like you were forbidden as of 1993 to listen to this music for a decade made the heart grow much fonder because like when it suddenly sort of came back, you're like, finally, yeah.
Mm-hmm. No, I had Chris McClernand on from Saigon Kick and he was kind of interested because they were pretty much a 90s band, but they were kind of an 80s more sound, right? I said, Chris, what was the difference for you between the 80s and the 90s? And he said, well, the 80s was, you know, Jack Daniels, happiness and cocaine. And the 90s was heroin and just sadness and depression. And I think that's true. I mean, not all bands in the 90s. I love a lot of 90s music, obviously, but it really was. It just, you know, naming the book Nothing But a Good Time, it's not just a Poison song. It really is a feeling of that era.
Yes. And you know, a feeling that came with sort of its downsides too, when people sort of start, you know, taking pot shots at the vacuity of the lyrics or the, you know, this or that. I think that the party hardiness of it was part of its undoing in a weird way, because, you know, it if you want to start picking apart, like, is there substance here, blah, 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 there is, and then the musicianship and stuff, but there, you can make arguments the other way as well. So, I think that when the mood in general of the culture changed, it became difficult for these bands that had been sort of, you know, celebrating excess and celebrating, you know, partying and this, that, the other thing, to make that transition. And a lot of them did try to make mm-hmm. a transition, you know, into Motley Crue, had a new singer and they tried to do some, and people just weren't, you know, buying it. And really good bands, especially the later bands, got caught in that transition, you know, like a Saigon Kick. Were they a glam metal band or a hair metal band? No, but did they, you know, have they been produced by Michael Wagner and did they have a hit ballad? Yes. So even though they've made these great records that were, you know, confrontational and you know, I thought great, you know, the Lizard, I think it's called one.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
It's a great record. But, you know, even they got like sort of caught in this thing and not allowed to reinvent themselves.
Yeah, it was almost like a tsunami, right? It just like washed all these guys and not, you know, they were still playing and stuff, but they weren't on the airways. They weren't. And like you said, there was kind of that thing, oh, you're not cool anymore if you don't like, you know, wear flannel and are sad, like you can't have fun anymore. So I really want to talk. So I was so impressed, and this comes from just having done interviews and stuff like this, 200 plus interviews, correct? And I think the thing, it's so amazing. So you do this in this style So it is an oral history. How hard was this to take all these different interviews and put them together so it reads so great as a narrative? It had to be difficult.
It's hard, and it's also fun. I gotta say, like, it is actually, as a fan of the music, it's fun, you know, because luckily you're interested in this stuff. And when it's difficult, it is when you're missing like one little key thing, because with the oral history format, it's all the people in the bands talking. And so if something happens, somebody in the band has to say it. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? Like, oh, and then he crashed his car. And if you don't have one of the guys in the band saying, and then he crashed his car, you got to call, get somebody on the phone again and have them say. But it's really fun. And so the way that we did it is we did a ton of interviews first, to like amass a huge amount of data and to make sure once the interviews themselves in this format dictate the story. So you can have an idea in your mind of like how you're going to tell the White Lion story. Mm-hmm. But if, you know, if there's something that you think is really important about their history and you ask the question to the four guys and they're all like, nah, I don't even remember that. You know, yeah. You're not telling that part. Like you're, so the each interview shapes the story and lets you know like, okay, I got to ask the next guy about this. I got to ask them about this. And then they'll bring up something that you hadn't heard of before. So it's a very, it's like a real living thing because you can't control what people are going to say. And so then you have to shape what they said. And so what we did, the hardest part wasn't crafting each individual band's arc. It was slicing them together. So what we really did with this book is wrote, you know, there are about 10 bands that we follow all the way through their arcs. We follow Warrant, we follow White Lion, Cinderella, you know, there's a big Guns N' Roses chunk. There Nelson, there are a couple bands, Vixen, that we follow all the way through. And we wrote their stories from beginning to end at Skid Row. And then when we had their stories, then we took these long strips, sort of like editing a film. And right. Then you start cutting, you know, you've got the film on the wall and you've got like 10,000 words on Skid Row. And then you start figuring out how to intersperse the different stories so that it just doesn't feel disconnected and there's a continuity. And one chapter on Skid Row is somehow slightly related to the next chapter on Cinderella, and it feels like it flows and not like you're being jolted mm-hmm. every single time you switch between bands. And that was the most difficult part, was like getting the flow of the book to once you had all of these different narratives to combine. We spent a lot of days on that.
Like a huge puzzle, right? It's like a huge, putting all those pieces together. Well, you pulled it off. It worked great. So.
Thank you very much.
So, you know, I'm sure you enjoyed talking to everybody, right? You're not going to say like, oh, they've sucked. But were there a couple people that you got to talk to you that you just had a fabulous time? It was just so much fun to talk to. Who were some of the highlights?
I mean, for me as a guitar player, and because he's a recluse, Vito Bratta from White Lion was a huge one. I think he had done an interview with Eddie Trunk in 2007. It was either 2007 or 13, and he has not really done any interviews since. And I owe it to Eddie Trunk. If you're not familiar, he's a DJ on. And I emailed Eddie, who I know a little from my days at Revolver and just from, you know, being around, and just asked him. I was like, "Would you forward an email to Vito Bratta?" And it was really important. I wanted to tell the White Lion story because I'm a big fan, and you obviously can't do it without him. Mm-hmm. Without Vito. And I guess we, like, the email landed in Vito's inbox on the right day, et cetera, et cetera. And he's like, yeah, I'll do it. And we ended up doing, I don't know, 3 hours over 2 days. And for me, because he was one of my favorite guitar players, and because he's got this very dry Staten Island Italian like humor to him, and a very, I think, clear, you know, he wasn't a guy who was getting loaded all the time. So he's got a very clear memory. Talking to him was just amazing. Also because there just haven't been really any interviews with him. So like that was a huge one for me. I've jokingly said, but it's not completely a joke, that maybe the whole book was a pretext for trying to interview him. But so that was absolutely totally fun. You know, some of the, like Doc McGee, the manager who managed Motley Crue and Bon Jovi and manages Kiss now, and you know, has had trouble with the law and stuff like that. That was a really, that was a good one because it was kind of scary. You know, like where you're, because he's like goofing and he's talking about how, you know, the guys from Motley Crue were insane, and he instructed his head of security, Fred Saunders, if he needed them. He's like, if you need to, punch them, you know. But he's also a guy like, you don't, like, I wanted to make it through that interview and ask him the questions I needed to, and not like have him suddenly be like, what do you mean by that?
Right.
You know, I didn't want my like Joe Pesci moment with him. So like that was do I amuse you? So that was great. A lot of people were just a great, like Gunnar Nelson is hilarious. And again, people like who have this total like perspective on what they've achieved. Ricky Rocket from Poison, the same, like they're you know, cause you're doing these interviews and you know what you've got, what you need. And when a guy or a gal is giving you, you know, like, oh, like that was funny. That was great. I needed that. And you're just like you're doing this interview and you're like, that was gold. That was gold. That was gold. That was funny. I didn't know that before. Wow. You know, and you're just like the bell keeps ringing.
Right.
That's where you're getting really psyched. And like Ricky Rocket again from Poison was willing to go through the whole band's history, you know. And he, you know, I was such a huge Poison fan when I was a kid. So that was really like where you're reaching back through time and like telling 15-year-old Tom, like, dude, you win right now.
yeah, you did.
And, right. And as a whole, though, I have to say almost everybody that we spoke to was great. And I think that that's a function of two things. One, that they were able to tell quickly that we were not going to ask them the three questions they always ask, like, do you think you look stupid on that record cover? Right. You know, or this, that, or the other thing. They could tell we knew our stuff, that we were interested, that like we had done our research, and that we were, not just that we had done our research, but that we were passionate about the music. And so that made it people really receptive. And also the fact that the people in these bands right now are mentally in a good place, because this music has really sort of recently been anointed, and probably some people reluctantly admit this, but it's like the new classic rock. Like people our age who get to decide
right
what is classic rock now have decided this is. And so these bands are out working.
Yeah.
You know, their contributions are being acknowledged. It's, you know, it's cool again to have been in these bands. If you had tried to do this book in 1997, it would have been a dark, dark affair, because these people couldn't even admit they were in these bands. So timing lined up too to make it that people were in general great to talk to.
Yeah. So Vito, that's really interesting you bring that up, because one of the things that he was the one at the Twisted Sister concert, right?
In yes.
Did you know that story ahead of time, or did he tell it to you? That had to be one of the moments that was dinging in your head, right? Like
I mean, and it's great because he's telling you that story. And like, you know, again, in his voice, he's like, so, you know, I'm standing there and I'm a guitar player. And I, you know, and he's like, and just the way he tells it is so dry, but funny. And you're like, I've never heard this before. And I wasn't even really aware, even though I grew up in New York, of sort of like the interconnectedness of these cover bands in the early 80s, and that they were all, you know, the guys in Skid Row and all these people are cross-pollinating. And then the best thing is that then you go, I got to interview Dee Snider, and I'm like, do you remember tearing Vito a new a-hole? And he's like, absolutely. And, you know, and he's like, and so you get Dee's perspective on it as well. And then that's the fun part of this book. And then you start talking to other people. Like there's a he's actually a friend of mine, this guy Keith Roth, who's one of the Hair Nation DJs.
And yeah, was, I listen to him all the time.
He's great. And he was, you know, he, in a previous life, he actually put out one of my band's records. I've known him forever. And like asking him, I'm like, so did you ever see Twisted back in the day? And he's like, oh yeah, this. And he tells you all the stuff about it. And you're like, did you ever see him take somebody out in the front row? He's like, oh my God. You know, and like he, you can tell it's still an incredibly vivid memory with him too. And he's like, there's probably people still talking about it in therapy. And so you build, you get this one unexpected story from a guy like Vito.
Right. And that's then, not what you were thinking. That was not what you thought he was going to tell you.
It's not what you thought. And then you go, once you get that and you're like, this is so, so cool. If you're lucky, which we were, you get to go and talk to, you know, Dee Snider. I even asked Eddie Ojeda about it too. And then Keith Roth. And like, you get to talk to the other people who are around and flesh this thing out. And that's really like sort of the great fun of doing a book like this.
Absolutely. Well, you'll get a kick out of this. My high school intramural basketball team, our name was Twisted Brother.
That's awesome.
And we used to, listen to, early Twisted Sister while playing basketball, you know, pickup games and stuff like that.
Wow. Were you, were you from Long Island or were you?
No. I'm from Lincoln, Nebraska, but wow. To your earlier point, like all that stuff was just, you know, there were like, we all listened to the same stuff. Cause there wasn't a bazillion choices.
We loved
the video and we loved D's attitude. Like we just thought D was like so funny. We just found him very, cause he didn't yell at me. So I was okay with it.
Right.
There's so many. And I, again, the book is nothing but a good time. The uncensored history of the 80s hard rock explode. And it is very uncensored. So there's so many, I want people to read the book. So I don't want to talk about all these stories, but Jack Russell shooting somebody when he was 18. I wasn't expecting that.
That is the, if you'll notice most of the quotes, you know, so this book is alternating quotes between people. They're all about 150 words long, you know, and then you move to somebody else. That's the one, the Jack Russell story is the one point in the book where we just let somebody run uninterrupted for, I think it's probably 1,000 words, 1,200 words. And it's because it's the most insane story in the book. When Rich did that interview and he called me after, he's like, and he knew about it like a little bit, like, so he touched on it, but he didn't know that he was going to get a full. So basically for your listeners, Jack Russell from Great White, as a youth, his side gig was robbing cocaine dealers of their cash. And he would often, to sort of, you know, instead of getting his courage from the bottle, he would get it sometimes from smoking PCP. And this one time he's going to rob a drug dealer and he smokes some PCP that's more potent, I guess, than what he's used to. And according to him, and he tells this whole story. And mind you, when he tells it, he's like, I'm telling you this because I think it could have some social benefit to people to not try and do things like this.
Yeah.
But he basically ends up blacking out while on PCP, busting into this drug dealer's house. And the housekeeper and I think somebody else locked themselves into the bathroom because they're so afraid of him. He busts down the door and his gun goes off. And basically, luckily, the bullet glances off the housekeeper's like golden medallion of saint, I forget which saint it is. And so she is spared, but he is also spared a lifetime in jail. And so Jack Russell tells this whole story and he's like, and then I woke up and there was a SWAT team there. And due to like a clerical error, he spends like something like 8 weeks in jail for this.
Yeah, that's nuts.
Comes out and the next day is on stage with Great White, you know? Right. And like, it's the craziest story in, like, really, because it's one of those funny, not funny stories. It's just so outrageous that we had to print the whole thing and just let it run, you know? And it's almost like weird because it doesn't really advance the story of the book. It's just one of these things, like when you get that in an interview, like that's going in the book.
Right.
Because it's so bizarre and it's so beyond, you know, with the oral history, I think a lot of the stories are like used as emblematic of other things in the book. Like, you can't tell everybody's story completely. So the Jack Russell story, I'm not saying that everybody else in the book was like a petty criminal and, you know, almost killed somebody, but you do get a picture with that, like, that a lot of these kids, you know, Nikki Sixx is a kid who came down from Seattle and was basically living in garbage cans, you know, like, these are not, a lot of these people didn't have fallbacks. They didn't have the greatest upbringings. They're like marginal characters, you know, who are like sort of like in this demi-monde and like getting by the skin of their teeth and getting into all kinds of stuff before they become successful. And like that story really, for us, like, kind of encapsulates, like, well, this is, if you want to fantasize about how close to the edge these guys were before they made it big, take this story, for example, you know? And so, and that's why it gets its sort of like pride of place in the book.
No, it's a great story. It's interesting too, to me, because those guys, most of those guys partied extremely hard, did a lot of dumb things. And it's amazing how many of them are still with us.
Yeah.
Where if you go with 90s, especially just 90s singers alone, we've lost a ton of them. So there's a luck factor involved in this too. I mean, Nikki Sixx, obviously, where he wakes up and he's got the, you know, still got the needle in his arm, right? Yeah. There's a lot of luck that a lot of these guys live through this.
Yeah. And I mean, and there's ones who, you know, Robin Crosby from Rat, and he succumbed eventually to complications from AIDS, but that's, you know, he was a regular user. Some of them, you know, the ones who do pass, a lot of them pass really early on too in their careers. It's, you know, like there's a guy from Jet Boy and stuff. But heroin was not the drug of, you know, there were people in this musical scene who did heroin, you know, and especially in the sort of Guns N' Roses, LA, Faster Pussycat scene. But I think it was mostly, you know, cocaine. And these were kids of the 70s too. So like they were smoking joints and taking, like doing lewds and when they had money doing cocaine. So it was definitely, I think, a different drug culture.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Another thing I found really interesting, you don't think about it, but it makes sense. But you know, before the internet, you know, Hollywood, California to a high school boy in Lincoln, Nebraska, that's like another planet, right? But
yeah,
these guys all, for the most part, not only knew each other, but hung out together. In some cases, they played in each other's bands or different iterations of their band and stuff. So it's almost like this book has almost kind of a high school reunion kind of factor to it, where all these guys were so close together, so intermingled. So, and then they kind of launch off, right? Like Van Halen's the first one that kind of takes off, and then it's Guns N' Roses takes off and Poison takes off. So I found that really interesting too. I assume you guys did as well.
Yeah. I mean, the thing about LA, especially in the later part of the decade of the 80s, LA has been like every kid from around the country who wants to make it in a hard rock band is in LA. So it's overrun, right? And so probably there's less of this thing. But in the early 80s, and this is something we definitely learned during the book, you know, Van Halen gets signed in like 77. And all these other bands are like, we think we're going to get signed now. You know, Van Halen got signed. But really, when you read Ted Templeman, the producer's book about signing Van Halen, when him and Mo Austin go to the Starwood to see Van Halen, they're not signing a poppy hard rock band. They see this guitar player and they're like, we need this guy on our label. He's the next Jeff Beck. He's the next, you know. And they're like, maybe we'll fire the band. We don't know. We just need this guy. He's as good as John Coltrane. That's literally what Ted Templeman said. And so these other bands that are around on the strip are like, we're next. But really no one gets signed for a while, you know, because really what was in vogue was new wave. So people are looking for Elvis Costello, the Cars, whatever. And the bands like Quiet Riot and even Motley Crue at the, you know, who are starting in the very early 80s are not cool, and they are not being sought after by the labels. And it's so, and they are marginalized. And so it is, and it is not a huge number of people doing this in LA at the time. So you've got Motley Crue and you've got, you know, London, and you've got the Quiet Riot guys and the Rat guys, you know, and Jakey Lee coming from San Diego to being a rat and then joining Ozzy's band and the guys in Dodge. And there's probably 200 people. I mean, I'm understating, but it's a small community, and it's a small community of people who are incredibly driven to make it. And there's like zero that, you know, they feel like, oh my God, there's one point where Mick Brown from Dawkins says, he's like, I was starting to freak out. I was 23. I thought I was never going to make it. Yeah. And there's an urgency that these guys have.
Right.
And so if they're in a band and they're like, this isn't clicking, they're out. They're in, you know, they go to the next, you know, or if there's a guy in a band that everybody feels is the weak link, he's out. So people are getting fired. They're joining. It's real musical chairs until people find the correct chemistry. You know, even so, a couple late years later than that, when Poison's original guitar player goes home to Pennsylvania, you know, you've got Slash and CC DeVille auditioning for the band, as well as like actually a friend of mine who ended up being in Venom, who's now Joe Bonamassa's guitar tech. Like, they were like lots of people. They all knew each other.
Totally.
And when it clicks, those are the bands we know about now.
Mm-hmm.
You know, but people were moving fast, particularly the birth of Guns N' Roses is incredibly confusing, because you've got, you know, Tracy Guns joining this one and leaving that one and this one. And it is literally like you would need a diagram, you know, like even I've read the book 20 times editing it, and I would probably still fail a test, you know, of that. But they were, it was a small community. And also LA is huge, but the Strip is very circumscribed. Mm-hmm. So these people are existing in a very geographically small area, and all the clubs are in a very close area. So there is constant contact between the people in these bands.
Yeah. I actually had Greg Renoff on and the Ted Templeman. Oh, wow. So if people have not read the Ted Templeman book, it's a great book.
Fantastic.
Yeah. Yes. Greg's super cool. Nice guy. He lives down. I still don't know why he lives in Tulsa, but I should have asked him that. It's kind of interesting. So when you brought up Jakey Lee, most of this book is just kind of fun. And obviously there's some sad parts too, but the Jakey Lee versus George Lynch, they both think they're playing for Ozzy, and how George Lynch, you don't have to tell all the story, but how he finds out this is terrible.
I mean, it's a weird George Lynch in our book. I don't feel bad, but like he's one of the guys who I feel like gets a little bit beat up in our book. I think he may not, I don't know him personally. It seems more like he's just like a guy whose personality might rub people the wrong way sometimes. And he's a little older, and when he really thought he had this Ozzy gig, I mean, he was traveling with Ozzy's band, and sort of like when Brad Gillis was filling in after Randy Rose died, and he really thinks he has it locked, and he's got kids, you know. So for him, this would be like a transformational moment. And he goes to, you know, and he thinks he's got the gig. But Jakey Lee gets a call too. And, you know, Warren G. Martini in the book says like Jake called him because they're buddies. And he's like, at that time, Warren G. Martini was the only guy who knew that both, you know, that like Jake was in the running too. And you can see sort of in hindsight why it happened. Like there is something about Jake, you know, and Greg, I mean, George Lynch posits that he didn't get the gig because he had cut his hair. And that, right, Jakey Lee had long hair. And you know what? That's possible, but there is a, when you watch the, you know, Ultimate Sin and Bark at the Moon videos, there's like a youthful energy to both Jake's like persona, but also to his playing. There's like a, you know, there's a like a speed and a lightness to the riffs that he brings that I think ultimately, you know, and it's easy to Monday morning quarterback or whatever, but I think makes him really was the right decision, like compositionally too. You know, the thing that you have to remember And this is why I think, I'm not sure of this, please nobody sue me, but one of the reasons people come and go from Ozzy's band is that I think if you're in Ozzy's band, even if you're bringing in a lot of ideas, you're not necessarily getting the songwriting credit. Mm-hmm. Like, I think that might be part of the deal when you're in the Ozzy Osbourne band. And look, Jake brings in that Bark at the Moon riff, you know, and he's got that whole bah, bah, da, 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 like, and that's his style. And I think that, you know, Sharon's really smart. Ozzy is obviously musically very attuned. Like that whole streak of Ozzy records would have been much like heavier. I don't want to use the word plotting, but more like if it had been George Lynch, it would have been a different thing. Would Ozzy have persevered? Probably, but like it was the right decision. But yeah, the way that basically it ends is very, very uncomfortable because George Lynch is present at Jake E. Lee's audition.
Right.
And he's like, hey guys, why is this guy Jake here? And nobody's talking. And then like suddenly Ozzy just walks up, you know, Jake and George are sort of standing there staring at each other uncomfortably. And Ozzy walks up and looks at George Lynch and goes, sorry, you've lost the gig. It's his now. And he just like walks away. And, right. And like, when you really think about that, like on a personal level, like if that happened to you, like if you were George Lynch, like what do? Like you go get a burger? Like do you crawl up in a fetal position? Like it's an enormous, you know, disappointment. And then he has to go back to Dokken where he hates the singer.
Right.
You know, and that seals his fate in Dokken for the rest of the decade.
Well, you know, it's just interesting. And so for people that are younger that weren't around when this all happened, you know, this was the gig for a lead guitar player. You know, Randy Rhoads had came out and blew everybody away for about, they wasn't that long.
No.
And died so young. And then like, who's Ozzy going to get in the band? Like this was, you know, like you said, Brad was in for a while, but Brad wasn't going to be the permanent solution. It was just, I would say this is the biggest for a lead guitar player. Only thing else I can think of is when Roth left Van Halen and, you know, Steve Vai got that gig. But yeah. Like, this is one of these things, like, this is transformational for a lead guitar. I mean, we know all these guys' names still, right?
Yeah.
You know, Zakk Wylde and all those guys.
It probably wasn't clear yet. I mean, people knew Ozzy wasn't totally Ozzy yet. Like, they had started to regain traction. You know what I mean? Like, it was a really good gig. And he could still, and he was playing arenas definitely, but it wasn't, but yeah, in hindsight, like that's the gig to get. And obviously for people who were trying to like skip a step, it was the ultimate gig. Like if you are Jake E. Lee, you're skipping 10,000 shows with Rat trying to get signed or whatever band you're in. And suddenly you're on the road and you're playing arenas, you know, and it was a huge gig and a huge responsibility. And a great, you know, training ground. I mean, the people like Zakk is amazing too. You know, a couple people have come and gone who didn't sort of stick like that, but it's a great gig because also you are, as a guitar player, suddenly paired with the greatest front man in the genre. So like playing amazing songs, you know, so you really are given this wonderful platform to sort of show your wares.
Right. And I don't think most people, well, you and I know this, but a lot of people, you know, Ozzy's younger than Sammy Hagar. I mean, I think we kind of get this idea that Ozzy's just like this elder statement. Right. And he was older, but you know, Black Sabbath, he was so young.
Yeah.
So when in the 80s, what was Ozzy in his 30s, late 30s?
Probably. I mean, I would say I would have to like Google it and I'd be cheating. I mean, when this is all going down, which is like 82, 83.
Right.
I'm going to just throw a dart and say 35.
Right. Which for at now, most. That's super young.
Yeah.
Especially for us now.
Yeah.
So that's not true. Well, I could spend all day with you and I want to talk a couple more stories. And I really tell people listening to this, if you loved anything about the 80s and rock and roll, if you just like a good story, this is a great book and please go out and buy it. I have a love-hate relationship with David Lee Roth. Okay. I love I think David Lee Roth is arguably the greatest frontman ever, right? I love David Lee Roth's albums when he's in the studio, and Ted Templeman, who we just talked about, and Don Landy are making him do it over and over again until he gets it right. Not real fan of the live shows, but Cinderella opening up for David Lee Roth. This is the greatest. This sums up David Lee Roth so well, right? This is where it's, and you should tell the story, but how it starts out and where it goes as Cinderella gets more popular.
I mean, this is David Lee Roth right after he exits. I will just quickly say that in our book, as much as Van Halen is like the musical genius of Eddie Van Halen, of Van Halen, to a T, every singer in our book bends the knee to David Lee Roth. You know, like they are like, he was the guy, we saw him at the, you know, and saw him at the Starwood, saw him there, like he was the greatest frontman. There was something that he was putting out, you know, that like these all, every other frontman in this genre was like, this is the template. Mm-hmm. You know, between the athleticism and sort of the ringmaster thing and the party atmosphere, which separates this music really from the heavy metal that comes before it. But fast forward, Cinderella are opening for David Lee Roth. And, you know, this is when Cinderella is completely ascendant. And David Lee Roth's solo career was successful, and I'm sure he packed many, many arenas, but like neither of the David Lee Roth, the two real peak solo albums, Eat 'Em and Smile and Skyscraper, they sell a couple million records, but they're not like 5 million sellers, which is, mm-hmm. you know, and Cinderella gets on tour with David Lee Roth and they are like ascendant. Like it is just, they're on MTV. It is, the jet is taking off. That record is just like, Night Songs is just enormous. It's like, they are the band of the moment. They had those great videos with the twins in them. It's exploding. And they suddenly, you know, they're doing more merch than David Lee Roth, this, that, the other thing. And suddenly their manager, Larry Mazur, who is a great storyteller and one, like really one of the people who pushes this book along, gets a call from David Lee Roth's management that's like, look, your guy Tom Kiefer is stealing David Lee Roth's stage raps. And he's got to cut it out or we're going to throw Cinderella off the tour. And Larry Mazur is like, look, man, Tom Kiefer is a really good singer and a great songwriter, but he's no orator. You know, he's basically up there going like, hey, are you having a good time, Tulsa? Awesome, let's rock. So he's like, if you're telling me that that is threatening the greatest frontman of all time, you're just full of shit. You're just, you know, so basically, yeah, David Lee Roth is, or somebody, and it probably is David Lee Roth, is watching this stuff and very aware, like that this band is like really on my heels and he needs to, and he feels the need, which is a little, it is weird that David Lee Roth, the king, feels the need to like tug the leash mm-hmm. on his opening band. And I mean, you hear stuff about that a lot in this book, but you also hear, it's funny, all, like conversely, anyone who opens for Bon Jovi in this book is like, they were the best. They're like, do you need more stage space? Do you need more lights? Do you need more PA? Is everything cool? And that's not, you would maybe expect that that would not be, you know, that, mm-hmm. oh, Dave's the nice guy. And, you know, so it is a weird thing. I mean, also there's the fact that the first time that Fred Corey from Cinderella sees David Lee Roth, David Lee Roth is urinating on Fred Corey's drum road case. But it is a strange thing, but you know, this, there's a lot of, you don't get to the top of this particular mountain being like totally sane and well-adjusted, you know, and it even stretches, you know, we spend a lot of time with Skid Row in this book mm-hmm. and a lot of, I, you know, and I did the Sebastian Bach interview and, you know, these guys in the day that Sebastian Bach joined Skid Row, he's like this 18-year-old. He's probably got ADD and oppositional disorder. These are not things that are diagnosed in 1987, you know, mm-hmm. and he's just like a ball of energy. And probably they were exhausted with him the first day he was there, but he turns them into superstars. And the people who confront these bands and mesmerize an arena, that's not a skill set that translates into being totally manageable the other 22 hours of the day. You know, that isn't the, there's, it just doesn't work that way. You can't go up there and project like that and feed off that energy and give that energy and then just flip a switch and just be like, hey, oh yeah, how's it going? You know, the amount of ego required is massive.
You know, the funniest thing I ever saw on Twitter was a picture. And I think it was Sebastian Bach had taken it, and it was him and Roth. This was like 5 years ago, so not that long. In first class, flying from somewhere in Australia, Sydney or Melbourne, to LA. And I thought to myself, and I bet you, Tom, you think the same too. It's like those poor other bastards in first class. They paid a fortune for those tickets. They're stuck in this super small confined space for like 15 hours with those two guys.
Yeah, I know. And like, just like it must, the amount of talking going with
it. Yeah. No, it would never stop.
Yeah.
There's just no way. And I'm sure they fed off of each other, right? You know,
absolutely. And also, you know, the thing with Sebastian Bach is he's a super fan. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, it's possible also that David Lee Roth himself was like, oh shit. Because like, Sebastian Bach is the guy who probably not only has every Van Halen record, but every bootleg of Van Halen on the 78 tour, and wants to know about the US Festival and wants to know about. So, you know, it was, yeah, there was probably a lot. There was a lot of vocalizing happening on that flight. Oh my God.
I can't even imagine.
No, it's probably fun. It's probably a $12,000 plane ticket.
That's what I'm saying. Like, you're like, I finally made it in life. I've got money. I'm going to get away from the cattle car, right, with the rest of the people. I'm going to live my life and finally enjoy this. And then that happens. But that's, you know, it's funny. I love the Rush documentary, which Sebastian Bach, when he talks about that, he was Rush like fan club number two.
Right.
Yeah. Kind of like you're talking about that reverence, but just all of he's on.
He's on
the whole time. Well, I really love the book. It was so much fun for me to read. I could talk to you for hours, but maybe have you guys back on at some time. But I really loved it. And I highly recommend, like I said, you don't even have to be a fan of the 80s to get a lot of fun out of this book. And it's everywhere, right? It's been out for a little bit while. The reviews were great. You got some really nice reviews too.
We got some really nice reviews. We got something which I dared hope for, but never said out loud. We actually... It is a New York Times bestseller. So like that was, we've been incredibly fortunate. Like, you know, I guess we put it out sort of at the right time, and there's a lot of people interested in this. And like, I'm just incredibly grateful that people are digging it, because it did take 4 years of my life.
Well, it would have to.
Yeah.
No, it would have to. So now that the world, you know, I'm all vaccinated, and actually went out. I'm so scandalous. I went out and had dinner inside last night. It felt like first time in like 13 months. Do you guys want to do a book tour at all? Or are you just like, nah, we're fine?
I mean, we would have loved to do. I mean, and again, it sounds petty in hindsight. It is the one thing that I regret. I think that probably the reception the book got and the sales have something to do with the time that we're in and people wanting to immerse themselves in this period that was so much fun for them. The one thing we didn't get to do was a book tour. And I had grand fantasies of a launch party in LA. Like, I think we've done well enough that there'll be a paperback. So hopefully we can do it then. And, it looks like, fingers crossed, I've been told that nothing in Hollywood is done until it's done, but it looks, we've been optioned for a documentary and a director who I can't mention, but who has a really good track record with sort of hard rock biopics and other things, has attached himself to it. So I think there's a good chance that there will be a documentary series. So maybe that will be where we get to do the launch party, where I get to go on stage and jam with CeCe DeVille.
Is that the dream?
That's the dream. That's the one honestly And I'm sorry, I'm rambling as you try to wrap this up. But like,
no, I'm happy to talk. I'm trying to be cognizant of your time, but I'm happy to talk to you as much as you want. So
the one, Vito is great. The other person, he's sort of like my spirit animal, and he doesn't do press. Like the one person who, there are a couple quotes from him in this book that we scrounged from other places. I really would have loved to interview CC DeVille because I think that I just love his energy. I love his songs. He captured my imagination as a kid. So yeah, that would be the dream, would be to jam with CC DeVille. That would be like, just have the lightning bolt vaporize me right then.
That's funny. You know, he seems so outgoing. I mean, he's certainly outgoing on stage and stuff. So does he just not like interviews, or is he just tired of talking to people? What's the deal?
He's been crapped on so much, even in this book. You know, even in this book, when they're talking about him playing the solo on Warrant's Cherry Pie, Bo Hill is like, the producer of the record's like, they wanted CC DeVille to play on that song because they were trying to get on the Poison tour, but that solo is not at the level of like what I like to have on records. And so there's always somebody taking a pot shot at CC DeVille. And I think that at a certain point, he just got tired of it. You know, he doesn't need it. Poison have, when you look, it's odd. We actually discovered this during the book, like at which band has the most top 10 actual Billboard singles, it's actually Poison. Like, so he doesn't need to do anything he doesn't want to. I don't know how I could communicate to him in advance that like my deep, you know, affection for him. So I think he's just like, I'm not doing interviews. The last time I think he did do interviews was 1999. He had a trio called Samantha Seven, which actually put out a really good like power pop record. And he did press around that and I got to interview him, but he's just locked down. Like, he's just like, there's no reason for me to put myself out there to like get sideways compliments and stuff. So it's a regret, you know, maybe one day, maybe he'll read the book and my phone will blow up.
So you talk to the other guys in Poison too? Did you pass on that your love for CC? Do they know?
They operate, they are for, except when they're on stage.
It's one of those situations?
Yeah, I mean, I think that like they operate just very independently. You know what I mean? Like, so like we got, you know, Ricky, I think it's a marriage of somewhat of convenience and of, you know, and they know like, dude, they can go out and play arenas.
Yeah.
So they're gonna do it, but I don't think they're texting back and forth with each other on the off hours. And I think like if CC DeVille doesn't want to do interviews, and they probably don't even bug him, they're probably just like,
yeah,
sorry, man. You know, good luck with your go make your book. CC's, you know. But yeah, I would have loved to talk to him because he's just such a character, and I think he would have been.
Oh, he's got so much personality. Yeah. I mean, it's sad because he'd be a great interview. There's no way he would, you know, you get some people on, and I've had some people on that they're just kind of monosyllabic and they kind of give you, yeah, no. And you're like, why are we doing this? Right.
Right.
But you have those people that just have so much, you know, I, for what it's worth, I know I kind of slagged him a little bit earlier. I would love to talk to David Lee Roth because David Lee Roth's going to tell you a lot of funny stories. Now I may get three words in 90 minutes, but you're going to get some good stories out.
You're going to get some. You will not get the answer to any question that you had prepared, but you will get an entertaining 90 minutes.
Did you interview him, or
Rich interviewed him, not for the book, but he's interviewed him for other things too. And that's how it rolls.
No, he was on Mark Maron recently, and I was like, you know, it's just roller coaster. It's going.
Yeah.
You just got off with a tangent you never thought, right?
Yeah. Just strap in.
No, that should be the name of this book.
I know.
Well, it was so much fun talking to you, Tom. We have an independent bookstore here that's really good, and they do a lot of events. So if you ever make it to Kansas City, I would love to say hello.
Awesome. Thank you. And likewise, and you know, have a nice re-entry into the world. I hope we all do.
No, I'm looking for, I got so many Groupon tickets for shows that they're just lining up. I'm going to be going to concerts for a long time, and that's perfectly fine by me because it's a lot of fun.
Awesome. Great.
All right,
thank you so much.
Have a good day. Take care.
Bye.
I'm going to Kansas City. Kansas City, here I come. Oh, yeah.
Again, that was Tom Bonjour. We were only supposed to talk for 30 minutes, but gosh, I had so much fun. That almost went an hour. So, Tom, thanks so much. It was so much fun talking to you, and so many great acts over that decade. It's just such a fun era. It was just a lot of fun, and thinking about it again, how did I become 53 years old? It doesn't seem possible. I'm 53 years old. But, you know, the beginning of the 80s now, that's 41 years ago. It's crazy. So in the show notes, I've got links to the book where you can get the book and you can check it out. Please buy it. It's a really good read if you love 80s rock music. So thanks to Tom for that. Hey, next time we're going to be talking to a bassist, Jed Chelbowski. Jed is a fabulous bassist from the East Coast. And he is recorded with some cool people. Kenny Arnoff, Vernon Reed, Gilby Clark, Doug Wimbish. On and on and on. He dialed in. So that's next week. Until then, go out, support live music, and we'll talk real soon. Bye-bye. Train, but if I have to